Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. My name is Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode we're playing The Crimson Tide, the 1992 fighting fantasy game book by Paul Mason with art by Terry Oakes. There's no notices this episode except my usual reminder that you can support my nonsense over on patreon.com/HJDoom, and receive a parcel of gaming material for your generosity, as well as access to my Patreon blog, where I'm making an effort to write regular reviews of things I think are neat. Paul Mason is a known quantity at this point, having contributed two previous books to the series with his writing partner Steve Williams. These were Slaves of the Abyss and Black Vein Prophecy. Both books were characterised by a degree of experimentation which I liked in theory, but didn't quite land for me in practice. Still, they were both memorable, which is nice. This is Mason's first solo outing. He said in interviews that Steve Williams treated the assignments more like a bit of fun, so I do wonder whether this means that Crimson Tide will have a more serious tone. Terry Oakes, the artist, is a veteran of the series by this point, having contributed covers to many fighting fantasy game books, including both Slaves to the Abyss and Black Vein Prophecy. He also did the cover of Tower of Destruction, which we covered last month. The only other internal art he did was for Black Vein Prophecy, and I remember it being solid, if unremarkable. The cover here is by Alan Craddock, and it's extremely busy, featuring an evil-looking white-faced man in garish robes, sitting on a throne in front of a prisoner being guarded by two shark-headed thugs. Also, there's some other animal-headed creatures just chilling behind the throne, and the shark-headed guards have big black wings for some reason. It kind of looks like Franz Frazetta's GCSE art coursework, if Frazetta had been on horse tranquilizers while making it. Considering how insane the cover is, I'm surprised I don't like it more than I do. It's got a subdued oriental flavour to it, so I'm hoping this doesn't indicate a bit of old-fashioned racism via the treatment of Eastern cultures as exotic and inscrutable, but we will find out. Okay, let's take a look at the rules. The first thing that the rules let us know is that we'll be starting at the age of 13 and gradually improving our stats as we grow up to adulthood. I would have been 13 when this book came out in 1992, so that's a nice bit of synchronicity. As a literal child, our starting stats are terrible. You've got your skill, stamina, and luck as usual, but skill is determined by rolling a single d6 alone, and stamina by 2d6 alone. I assume this means we can acquire a maximum of 6 skill and 12 stamina over the course of our adolescence. Luck is generated as usual with 1d6 plus 6, which makes sense since luck is not something you get better at as you get older. In general, I think you get less lucky as you get older. You've only got to look at the high turnover of the world's oldest men and women to see that. That award, really a poison chalice, you have to say. We also get a new stat because of course we do. This is called Ferocity and it starts out equal to 1d6 plus half your stamina rounding up. Ferocity is a measure of our thirst for vengeance and general angriness. I quite like the idea that you can roll the minimum ferocity of 2 and have a character who wouldn't mind getting revenge but honestly isn't that invested in it and could quite happily just eat a sandwich instead. With a massive range of 2 to 12 for your starting value, going from near pacifist to Tory backbencher, I predict that ferocity will actually have little impact on the book as a whole. I certainly hope that it has a little impact, since a 10-point range is very difficult to actually balance in a game book. The only reason why the 10-point range of stamina is possible to balance is because of the way stamina is just gently chipped away at over time. You very rarely roll your stamina. We start with nothing except the clothes on our back. So I've rolled up a character who I've decided to call Calorie O'Brompton, because that seems to me a name ripe with heroic potential. Calorie has a skill of 2, which is rubbish, a stamina of 12, which is excellent, and a luck of 12, which is excellent, and this gives them a starting ferocity of 8. They might not be good at fighting, but what they lack in skill, they make up for in sheer size and anger. Good times. With all that out of the way, let's play Crimson Tide. Background. Your world is a world of mud and water. Ever since you were a baby, all you've known are the simple baked mud houses of your village and the vast watery expanses of rice paddies, interspersed here and there by pastures. So it looks as though we are going for some old-fashioned Orientalism right out of the gate. Although you have not yet entered your 14th summer, you are used to working in the fields. You are lucky to have been born strong and hardy. At the end of a day spent planting tender shoots in the mud, you still have some energy left for play and for practice. And indeed, I am very hardy indeed. So that's nice. You fancy yourself a mighty warrior, like those who occasionally ride by, so you have carved a sharp stick for your sword and swing it in circles above your head. At first the other children laughed at you, but after you killed a giant mudworm, they learned a new respect for you. The events of the outside world rarely concern you. Even when you hear that there is civil war in the land, your only concern is that the soldiers won't harm your rice crops. Rice is a luxury. A good rice crop means wealth, and most goes in taxes to the tribunal. No, you care little for the great events of the kingdom. After all, one king is much like another. Pu-tar has never done you any favours, so what do you care if he is replaced by some other divine ruler? Ah, sensible words to live by. Would that the people of Great Britain had the same attitude to their own royal family. Then one day the foreign mercenaries arrive in your village. The gleam of their black lacquered armour makes them look like horribly distended beetles. Their gimlet eyes shine with evil intensity. The villagers who stand in their way are ruthlessly hacked down. They collect all the rice and round up all the women, including your mother. Your father protests, and as you watch, the leader of the mercenaries cuts him down with his narrow, slashing, curved blade. "The new king seeks slaves," says the coarse-tongued barbarian, "and you scum aren't going to get in my way." You stare at the man, fixing his appearance in your mind. His armour is composed of scales, laced together with occasional plates and spikes covering vulnerable areas. His helmet is wide and his face is covered by a fierce, bestial mask. It is a scowling parody of a man with bulging brows and wickedly curved horns. Through large holes, the evil brown eyes of your father's attacker return your stare with what could almost be amusement. Then, with a yell, the mercenaries mount their horses and leave, driving their captives before them with whips. The horses make slow progress through the flooded fields, and it seems to take an eternity before the killers disappear from sight. Your father dies in your arms. His last words are, "Go to the Bauchu Monastery. Avenge me. Save your mother." So there is the introduction, and again, 2 pages. Nice, short, sharp introduction. Dumps us right into the middle of the action, which you all know I really like by now. Yeah, onwards to the first proper section. There's a big bit of art on the facing page showing a man with the rather ugly mask and what looks a lot like samurai armour standing over the kneeling and begging body of a villager. You can see light streaming behind him as though he's standing in front of possibly the setting sun. It's actually really nicely composed. It's not necessarily the most technically sophisticated, but it is very dramatic and really gives you the idea that this is a moment of high drama and tragedy. Yeah, really good. You leave your village with several other youngsters, all determined to seek revenge. You carry with you your wooden sword, make a note of it on your equipment list, and some food. Note down that you have 2 provisions. The paddy fields lie all about you with the sun sparkling on the still, muddy water. You make your way along a path on top of a polder, the low earth barrier separating one field from the next. Several kilometres distant is the local town of Yenshu, in which the magistrate of your district holds his tribunal. You have never been there yourself, but your cousin Quan visited Yenshu's temple 2 years ago, so he knows the way. Not much is said on the journey until you arrive at the road which leads to Yenshu. Here, where the polder tracks join the wider thoroughfare, a small settlement is to be found, an inn and the huts of several artisans. The foreign mercenaries have been here too. The buildings are scorched and blackened from fires, and broken pottery lies strewn all around. Suddenly, little Hanny lets out a shriek and points. The bloodied corpse of another victim sprawls amid the wreckage of the horse trough. "We must have vengeance upon these murderers," says Sunai, the eldest of you, clenching her fist. "The magistrate in Yenshu will deal with them," replies Quan, who already has the bearing of a monk, though he is not yet even a novice. You stand amongst the wreckage, discussing the fate which you hope will befall the mercenaries, while Sunai counts the slain. Quan says he believes the invaders are from far across the seas, from the land of Haichiman, where the men are savage and primitive and accustomed to mistreating women. "Barbarians such as these," he points out, "have a crude religion reflecting only a fragment of Arn, and so have no foundation upon which to build a civilization. Their land is ruled by warriors who are constantly warring with one another." Quan sounds to me like an insufferable know-it-all. Sunai finishes her unpleasant task and reports that 6 men lie dead here. Now you must hurry to the magistrate to report the matter and set the wheels of justice in motion. But the barbarians may still be stalking the land. If you hurry along the road to Yenshu, you may catch up with them. On the other hand, if you travel to Yenshu along the polder paths, the journey will take much longer, and it will be more arduous for the younger children. You have the wooden sword in your hand, and it seems that you are the leader. Do you decide to travel along the road, or would you prefer to make your way among the rice paddies? Well, with a whopping skill of 2, I do not want to be running into any barbarian mercenaries, so I think we will go for the rice paddies, and, you know, if a couple of children die, better them than me. You trudge along the polders, checking with Quan every now and again to make sure he knows the proper route. Soon you begin to see a range of hills which rises abruptly out of the plain ahead of you. The steep slopes are lush with rich green foliage. Quan points excitedly towards them. "Yenshu lies just south of those hills," he cries. No sooner has he spoken than there is a dreadful, sucking noise from the field to your left, and a slime-covered mudworm, fully as long as a man, rears up, its blind snout questing towards Quan. It will be on him in moments, unless you can intercept it and fight it off. So the giant mudworm has a skill of 12 and a stamina of 6. I cannot defeat the mudworm. I cannot actually land a blow on the mudworm because with my skill of 2, if I roll a 12, that gets me to 14, which is the lowest attack score that the mudworm can possibly manage. So I'm not even going to roll a dice. I just straight up die. Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, skill 12, stamina 6 for your first fight. Absolute nonsense. I guess that's indicating that we should take the journey along the road rather than along the rice paddies. Dying immediately after making precisely one choice is some proper old school brutal game book design. Have we ever had an instant death on the very first choice? I'm not sure we have. This may be literally the very earliest I've ever died in a fighting fantasy book. So there we go. Always new things to discover. Obviously, I'm going to invoke the sausagey finger bookmark rule. We will go back to the first section and we will take the route along the road. The roads in your district are frequently used by the merchants who come to buy surplus rice from the peasants. Strangely, there are no merchants in sight on this road, and after walking for an hour, you discover the reason. A small cloud of dust appears ahead of you, then resolves itself into the shape of a fiercely armoured mounted warrior, perhaps one of the mercenaries who attacked your village. He will be on you in moments. The rest of the children flee into the rice fields. Do you want to run after them, or would you rather wait to try and ambush the mercenary? I'm going to try and ambush the mercenary because surely the author won't attempt to murder me again so soon into the book. You crouch behind a polder and hold your breath as the horseman comes to a halt, sending up a cloud of dust. He shouts in a harsh accent, "You ratlings, come here!" His harness jingles as he dismounts. Now is your chance. You leap out from your hiding place and charge him, brandishing your trusty wooden sword. Roll two dice. Is the total less than your ferocity? It is. You let out a blood-curdling yell as you swing your wooden sword at the barbarian. Taken by surprise, he staggers back, grunting in pain. You follow up with a thrust to the stomach, but he is too quick for you. Grabbing the end of your sword, he tugs sharply, unbalancing you. Before you can dodge away, he is upon you, pinning your arm behind your back. "Ha! You fight like a saber-tooth," he snarls. "Perfect for the arena." Somehow he manages to tie your hands together and throw you across the back of his horse. The jolting ride that follows bruises every bone in your body. Eventually, you arrive in a town and clatter through its streets. You are delivered into the arena, where you are put into training under the master swordsman Jayan, a muscular fellow with a strangely curved right eyebrow. Closely guarded by day and night, you are taught the use of sword, spear, halberd, bow and axe. Jayan teaches you well. After 2 years, you are nearly his match and ready for your first opponent in the arena. Throughout all this time, you never forget your parents, and the fire of vengeance in your heart is fueled with each passing day. Add 2 to your age, 6 points to your skill, 10 points to your stamina, and 10 points to your ferocity. Okay, so we're now 15. Now have a skill of 8, a stamina of 22, luck is still 12, and our ferocity is now 18. Seems very high. Finally, the day of your debut dawns. Jian has told you that your first battle is the most important. You are led out before a howling crowd and face a ravening arena beast, a leathery nightmare with soul-draining eyes. There is a picture of the beast. And yeah, fair play. Looks like a lizard. It's shown straight head on, sort of a bipedal lizard. I guess kind of like a lizard man, you might say. Big snaky head lowered, talons outstretched towards you. Sort of looks like it's running directly at you, and sort of like it's been caught in the middle of doing the time warp from Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's a decent enough bit of art. The arena beast has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 13, so I should defeat it. However, each time the arena beast injures you, roll 2 dice. If you roll less than your skill, you've avoided looking into the eyes of the beast. If you roll equal or greater to your skill, you have gazed into the eyes of the arena beast, and you must lose an additional point from both your skill and ferocity. So, if it hits me and I fail the skill test, the calculus of beating it suddenly starts to look a lot less likely. Okay, for the first time this adventure, I'm going to roll some dice. I have died. Again, that's the second time in quick succession. So here's the thing. skill drain that's not capped is a terrible idea, because obviously I was doing fairly well against the arena beast right up until the point I lost my first point of skill, and that made it then less likely that I would win combat rounds against the arena beast. Every time he won in a combat round, I then had to roll to avoid losing skill again, and of course, the more skill you lose, the more likely it is that you will fail the roll to retain any further skill, because there is actually a very sharp bell curve to the distribution on two dice. Sort of a bell triangle, I guess. Yeah, so as soon as I lost 2 points of skill, I didn't pass another skill test, and I ended up on zero skill, just being repeatedly bitten by the arena beast. So, not good design. You can do skill drain, particularly if you're planning to mess about with the player's skill over the course of the adventure, but you should definitely cap skill drain. I think probably this is an effect that should only trigger once during a battle. Losing skill is already one of the most rubbish feeling things you can do in an adventure game book. It's up there with level drain in old school Dungeons and Dragons, where it just feels absolutely terrible, because not only does it deplete your ability for this fight, it depletes your ability for all future fights. And there's presumably going to be a lot of fights. Anyway, I've died. So, again, I'm going to invoke the sausagey finger bookmark rule. How long has it been since I did a double sausage bookmark rule? It's got to have been a while. Anyway, I'm invoking it once again, because far too soon, barely got a taster of this game book so far. It's not endearing itself to me, I have to say, in these early stages, but maybe it'll swing round and it'll be fine from here on in. I have defeated the arena beast, we'll say, and to be honest, I'm going to just say I've got my starting stats, because it seems like I need all the help I can get. With the arena beast slain, you recognise an opportunity to escape. If you can leap up into the crowd, you might be able to lose yourself in the crush. You disguise your intention by walking round the arena, your sword raised in triumph. Then you nimbly vault over the barrier into the tiers of spectators. Chaos erupts around you. Roll 3 dice. Is the result less than your ferocity? Yes, it will be, because my ferocity is 18. With a roar that would turn a young man's hair grey, you frighten away the spectators and race up the arena stairs. A guard faces you at the top, but you bowl him aside and leap into space. Luck is with you, for your fall is broken by the stall of a meat vendor. You pick yourself up from the wreckage of his tent, snatch up a piece of roasted meat on a stick, and leap upon a nearby horse. Then you are riding like the wind, howling your defiance at your captors and whirling your sword about your head. Note down that you have a sword and a roasted meat stick, which counts as 1 provision. Provisions now 3. Ooh, and we write down the word arena on our character sheet. So, keyword, that's exciting. You ride for hours until the sparkling blue expanse of the sea opens up on your right. Turning inland, you ride through rice country similar to your home district. Time passes, and mountains loom up on the horizon. Then, all at once, the horse stumbles. You land with a splash, unhurt, but the horse has fared worse. You have driven the poor beast too hard, and it cannot continue. You have to abandon it here and continue on foot into the lower slopes of the mountains. I mean, it's a good thing to abandon the horse, because this way there's no chance of the horse sneaking up on me and killing me in my sleep, which is what I genuinely believe all horses really want to do. I can never work out why no one else can spot that horses are in fact just evil. A plume of smoke rises from an encampment a few kilometres away, and even from this distance you think you can make out the distinctive black armour of the mercenaries. Do you want to creep up close, remaining hidden, or march boldly into the camp? I feel as though it might be fun to march boldly into the camp. I mean, it's been 2 years. Will they remember me? I think not. I mean, I can barely remember what happened to me last week. and my life is much less exciting than a mercenary's. So yeah, I'm going to march boldly into the camp and see if I can sign up. The sun is shining brightly overhead as you stride confidently into the camp. Sure enough, these are the barbarians who destroyed the tranquility of your village life. Is your age 15 or over, or is your age less than 15? My age is 15 or over. The barbarians look you up and down as you enter their camp, but not one of them lifts a weapon against you. Do you have the word never written on your adventure sheet? I do not. You approach the central tent in the camp and beat upon the little drum which hangs by a flap. There is a grunt from within. The fearsome figure of the mercenary leader emerges, his face hidden by the demon mask. Do you want to attack him immediately, or would you like to talk to him first? I will talk to him first. You look up into the impassive mask of your father's murderer. Well, what is it? He demands. Do you want to accuse him of murder, or would you ask to join his mercenary band? I like the idea of joining this mercenary band. Revenge is a dish best served cold, and I feel I have still more to learn before I try and take out the mercenary leader. So we'll go for trying to sign up. Are you tattooed? I am not. I will say this is doing a great job of suggesting that there's quite a few different ways to approach the story. He laughs in your face, hissing like a snake. Take yourself out of here, brat, before I teach you what it means to be a mercenary. Well, that sounds like fighting talk where I come from, so I am going to attack him. Interesting that ferocity completely ceases to be relevant as soon as it's an inconvenience. I kind of expected that this would be how it would work, but I think the more interesting thing to do would be to make ferocity a really central thing so that you're always struggling not to simply do the most violent thing at any given time. It wouldn't necessarily make for the most interactive game book. I think you have to be very careful about mechanics that take away agency from the player. But I think as something experimental, it could be really good fun. Maybe not for the whole of a game book, maybe with a few little bits here and there. Anyway, we choose how we're going to attack the mercenary leader. There's a choice of magic, arena skills, martial arts, a wooden sword, pronged spear or cudgel, with the sacred sword of Tsui, or with a monk's staff or knife. Now, of these, we only have access to the arena skills, so we will try that. You crouch, remembering the lessons Jian taught you. No fancy flourishes, no wasted energy. Just look for an opening and exploit it. But your opponent is skilled too. You cross swords a dozen times with neither of you gaining an advantage. As he is wearing armour, you realise you'll have to try something special if you are to win. You feint to his head, then try a leg sweep. He falls but grabs your leg and pulls you down with him. Then you are wrestling on the black soil. He rolls on top of you, the devilish mask staring ferociously down at you. The sun glints on the horns of his helmet and he brings his head down sharply. Your adventure ends here. Okay, well, I guess this is a book that is absolutely determined to murder me and make this a shorter recording than usual. So, who am I to quibble? I don't think I'm going to invoke the sausagey finger bookmark rule again. We've already done two, and I do have to pay at least some lip service to the idea that we only play till I die. So yeah, I guess that's the end of this recording. Shorter one than usual, for which I apologise, but don't blame me, blame Paul Mason. Even in this relatively short glimpse we've seen of the book, I can already see that there's some really interesting ideas in here. I'm very much looking forward to finding out how many different paths we can take to get to this mercenary captain, who feels like a sort of mid-game boss, I suppose. I mean, I assume there's going to be a world in peril kind of bit of the plot at some point. Not that I'd be disappointed. I think trying to slay a mercenary captain would be a perfectly reasonable plot for a game book to have, but I feel as though something much bigger will be lurking in the background. So there's lots of stuff in there that seems intriguing, What I'm not sure about is whether I've just been unlucky and made some poor decisions, or whether this book is just ridiculously deadly. So that's something that I'll be looking at when I play through off mic. I'll be coming back in just a few seconds with some closing remarks. Tatty bye. It's always interesting when a recording goes short. Is it because I'm an idiot? Or is it because the book is really hard and also I'm an idiot? In the case of The Crimson Tide, it's very much the second one. This is one of those books with only one real solution. It's brutally hard on several different levels, but if you embrace that difficulty, there's almost more fun to be had in wandering down the blind alleys than in grinding your way to the optimal solution. It's a book that took me on a roller coaster journey through frustration and despair before ending up in a place of acceptance and even joy. It's a glorious mess that simultaneously operates like a beautiful puzzle box and also makes no sense at all. It's that rare combination of genius and stupidity where the worst elements only serve to make the whole thing that much more memorable. It's one I'll be thinking about for a long time. It's worth noting that one of the things that makes the book so difficult, that opening fight with the incredibly hench mudworm, is allegedly a mistake by the editor. Although I haven't found the exact interview where he says this, I've seen reports in multiple places that Paul Mason said the fight should have been with a skill 6 monster rather than a skill 12 monster. A skill 6 monster would have still been a big ask to beat for a character with a maximum skill of 6 and a maximum stamina of 12, but it would have been a lot more doable than the fight we actually got. The optimal path through the book doesn't involve the fight at all, which also makes it somewhat more forgivable. Even as written, it doesn't break the game book, which is nice. It's also not a book in which combat is a large element. There's only a handful of fights on the correct path, and they are all fairly manageable. You do need to roll a decent skill to be confident of getting past them, but that's the case with so many fighting fantasy books that it doesn't qualify as a mistake. It's just part and parcel of writing a fighting fantasy book. You have to pick a skill that you're going to pitch at, and yeah, this one pitches it high. That's fine. One thing that quickly becomes clear is this is very much a sequel to the book Black Vein Prophecy. As well as taking place in the same location, it also features some of the same characters, with the protagonist of that book even cropping up in a key role. I said in the introduction that this book was written as a solo offering rather than being co-written with Steve Williams, and in some ways this feels like an attempt to really bring a specific setting to life in a way that didn't quite happen in Black Vein Prophecy. Paul Mason clearly had a very specific ambience that he wanted for the Island of the Dawn, and it wasn't necessarily the same ambience that Steve Williams was going for. This highlights one of the risks of writing with a partner. You end up with something that compromises both visions. It's interesting when contrasted with Way of the Tiger, the books we've been covering in the bonus episodes, where it seems like the writers are very much on the same page. In this case, it's only without his writing partner that Paul Mason is able to give us a version of the island that feels consistent and coherent and very much drawing on a particular set of aesthetic considerations. This is something that the art does a great job of complementing and reinforcing. Terry Oakes has done a sterling job with the illustrations. They've got a strong Far Eastern influence, but he's resisted the urge to caricature. Indeed, these are some of the most realistically proportioned figures in fighting fantasy, and the sense of veritas goes a long way towards avoiding accusations of crass Orientalism. Obviously, as a mediocre white man, I'm the last person who should be passing judgment on matters of racial and cultural sensitivity, but from my extremely ignorant perspective, it does seem like there's been efforts made to treat the inspirations with a degree of seriousness. Medieval China makes a very pleasant change to Western Europe as a backdrop, and it's a joy to see it properly realised in this book, when it was so clearly hampered in Black Vein Prophecy. There's an earnestness to the tone as well, which marks it out as a much more considered book than the more incoherent and tonally eccentric Black Vein Prophecy. There are some moments of levity to be found in Crimson Tide, but overall it feels like it takes its world seriously, which is nice. We should look at the structure. On the one hand, this has a wonderfully open structure. There are a number of locations you can visit in a variety of different orders, depending on the decisions you make. There's a monastery, two towns, and various points connecting them both in time and space. My journey in the recording was actually one of the simplest. I opted out of most of the interesting digressions and just ran pell-mell towards a fatal encounter with the mercenaries from Hachiman, which I'm sure I don't need to remind you is the land from Sword of the Samurai, the one that's straight up just Japan with the serial numbers filed off. I was never going to survive this encounter. I had simply avoided most of the actual book. I love books that let you skip to the end, so this was a strangely pleasant realisation. Not the best for recording, but still pretty cool. I had basically wound up on the fastest and least helpful path to the final confrontation with the killer of my father. Nice to know that despite doing 46 episodes of this podcast, I haven't lost my touch. One thing that gradually becomes obvious as you play through the Crimson Tide is that there isn't a single ending, but a plethora of endings more akin to a choose-your-own-adventure book. Depending on the choices you make, you can end up taking the mercenary leader's place, achieving enlightenment and becoming a monk, ending your life as a slave in the mines or the arena, or simply settling down to a life of basket weaving. One of the questions this book asks is what constitutes a good ending to a fighting fantasy story? Although the framing device is a quest for revenge, the actual theme of the book is more about transcending the desire for revenge. And while there's definitely an ending that lets you have your cake and eat it too by saving your mother and defeating the mercenary leader on the way to learning to live without vengeance, that there's actually a theme at all is pretty remarkable for a series that trades almost exclusively in pulp fantasy and adventure tropes. When morality comes up at all in fighting fantasy books, it's either in the crudest possible framing of idealised notions of good and evil, or the authors thoughtlessly recapitulating problematic elements of the real world that they haven't thought about enough. To have a fighting fantasy game book where the character needs to come to a personal realisation about the futility of revenge and the cyclical nature of violence is astonishing and deserves enormous praise. Once you realise this, you also become aware that several of the endings that feel like failures aren't actually as bad as you thought. In actuality, there's nothing wrong with being a basket weaver, or a sailor, or a monk. Simply choosing not to be ruled by vengeance is a victory in itself, and crucially, it's a victory over the people who have wronged you as well. A lot of the most awful people really enjoy having power over others and knowing that they have come to define the lives of the people they have hurt. Forgiveness can be a radical act of self-actualization because by doing that and moving on, you are free to define your life for yourself, no longer enslaved by the one who hurt you. It is, of course, much easier said than done, but at the very least, this book seems to be suggesting that learning to be yourself and to ignore other people is a valid and healthy response to trauma, and that this can be a part of growing up. There's some mechanical support for this premise in the way the book starts you off at the age of 13, and then allows you to spend some years on your quest, making it a proper coming-of-age story. There's plenty of opportunities to spend years in a particular place and add to your meagre starting stats. This sort of works, and sort of doesn't. The way in which it works is that getting better through the passage of time is appealing and helps hammer home the idea that the person who finishes the adventure is not the same person who set out on the adventure. You don't often get much of a sense of progression in fighting fantasy books, which is odd on one hand because the role-playing games that provide the inspiration for the series were all about progression. Partly that's an artifact of the premise being a single adventure rather than a campaign. In most role-playing games, levels are accrued fairly slowly, so the timescale of most game books doesn't really allow for that to be a feature. You sometimes get the odd improvement to your scores along the way, but progression is generally minimal and often defined more by your gear than your ability scores. It's something that books like Destiny Quest and Legendary Kingdoms make a central feature, but that's often at the cost of a less involving narrative style. The more ground you want to cover in a game book, the less detail you'll be able to provide. Starting with terrible stats and then growing in power works very nicely in The Crimson Tide, and it's something that works better when you know that the usual range of starting stats is 7 to 12 rather than 1 to 6. If this was your first fighting fantasy game book, you wouldn't know any better, but being aware that the usual rules are being fiddled with makes a canny player feel a little bit nervous from the off. You're aware that even the simplest challenges from other books in the series would be a big ask for the character you're now playing. The downside is that if there's one thing that game books struggle with, it's dealing with the passage of time. This is something that linear books do better than more open designs. The closer playing a game book is to reading a novel, the more realistic the passage of time feels, because the fewer options the player has, the easier it is to write later portions of the text which feel like the natural sequel to what has gone before. This gets harder when there's more choice, and in particular, when there's a choice about how much time you spend between two locations. The easy way around this is to create a series of areas which are only thinly connected to each other and provide lots of choice and time passing within those areas. This is one reason why the travelogue is such a natural fit for game books. However, sometimes you want to provide the player with a lot of choice in terms of where they go and what order they do things, including the possibility of revisiting an area. To do this, you actually create two versions or more of the area to represent subsequent visits. This more or less works, but ultimately there's a bit of sleight of hand involved, because time in game books tends to be represented spatially in the construction of the book. Areas are separated by sections, more importantly than they're separated by words. And that's a function of the relatively terse style you generally need to adopt for a game book in order to keep it focused on that sense of player agency. In general, game books find it easier to track whether you have visited an area rather than when you visited an area. You can do the latter, but you'll need to have a fairly robust mechanical means of tracking time, and even then there's an upper limit to the number of different versions of an area you can fit into a game book without it getting unwieldy. Creating five different versions of an area depending on what the player has done before visiting it sounds cool, until you realise that you've got to spend a quarter of your section count on an area the player will actually only visit once or twice, and both times fairly briefly. Suddenly you've got an adventure which is very good at tracking time, but actually feels incredibly short because you don't have the space to actually tell a story. You're creating a realistic sense of the passage of time, but that doesn't land because the actual number of sections that the player reads is very short. Inevitably, you have to compromise, and the easiest way to compromise is to simply track whether a player has been to an area before or whether they've found some key element in the area. If you allow players to visit the same area multiple times, you'll usually need to find a way to have guards or traps come back, and we saw that in Tower of Destruction, with certain magical monsters respawning when you come through a second or a third or a fourth or a fifth time. In theory, the approach taken with the Crimson Tide is appealing. You can use the player's age to track the passage of time. The problem is that there's so much else going on that the author doesn't have the space to track both the age and whether you visited an area before in order to create a believable sense of the passage of time. He uses code words to track events rather than your age, except for a couple of occasions. This ends up highlighting the biggest and the most common issue with game books and time, that the encounters exist in a frozen state of potential until the player comes along, no matter how long it takes for the player to come along. The goblins are always playing dice behind door A until you've been through once and murdered them, at which point they quite understandably stop playing dice. What the age system unfortunately does is really make this element stand out. How long has it been since your village was destroyed? It could be a few days or it could be 4 years. Regardless, the mercenary camp will still be there waiting for you, exactly as it's always been there waiting for you. Whatever nefarious plans the mercenaries have, they make precisely zero progress towards completing them over a time period of anywhere between several days and 5 years. The same is true for the ultimate bad guy, who is constantly on the verge of executing their nefarious scheme until you come along to foil it. It was something that was always going to be an issue with this kind of design, but the age mechanic draws attention to it. Most players want to be able to suspend their disbelief and are willing to overlook the compromises that game books force designers to make. It's much harder to do that when the author is unhelpfully drawing attention to the fact that nothing actually happens for half a decade unless the player is there to witness it. The book will even allow you to hang on to the same provisions you started with for several years and they'll still be perfectly edible. Presumably they're those awful sandwiches you get from petrol stations where bread is the third listed ingredient after ash and rubber, which have a best before date measured in ice ages. Ultimately, this is a symptom of an issue with the book, which is that it's trying to do an awful lot in 400 sections. Not only do you have the age system, you've also got a new stat, ferocity, and a code word system, which is tracking various elements of the story. That code word system is also doing double duty because, as well as tracking the player's actions and experiences within the story, if you get the code words in the right order, it will also reveal when you need to use the solution to a riddle, which opens a hidden section. Ferocity, as I correctly predicted, is something of an irrelevance. Theoretically, it measures your rage and thirst for revenge, and in this it fails. It fails badly. Like most mechanics that threaten to take away agency from the player, it's used sparingly for the intended purpose. Only occasionally will your ferocity have even a chance of getting the better of you. On one level, this is the right call because it avoids the obvious risk that the gamebook ends up playing itself via the dice. The problem is that the mechanic ends up feeling like an afterthought. I found myself asking why I wasn't being asked to make a ferocity roll more often. You could definitely make something like ferocity work, but it would need to be a centrepiece of the book. You would have to carefully design plenty of encounters that could affect your ferocity score via the decisions that you make, and then have a series of key encounters that depend on your ferocity score. And you'd have to make it so that those key decisions were not decisions that should be made by rolling against your ferocity, which is a very difficult needle to thread. Essentially, you'd have to make managing your rage into the central concern while simultaneously giving the player agency over how they manage their rage. Really hard. If you're not going to do that, I think it's better to leave it out. Mechanically, though, ferocity is actually doing something quite interesting in this story. It's not actually about your ferocity rising, it's about your ferocity dwindling away until you've transcended your need for revenge. It feeds in very nicely to the themes of the book. When your ferocity hits zero, you get a little bonus, and that's a really cool thing to discover. It's just unfortunate that this brilliant and unexpected mechanic works, but at the cost of ferocity, as it's described in the rules, broadly failing to work. Having a stat that ticks down and having that be a good thing is awesome, not least because it's a fun inversion of things like stamina and luck, where they tick down and that's a bad thing, but I'm not sure how you would square that with the premise of what the stat is actually claiming to represent. It's clever, but like the age mechanic, that cleverness comes at the cost of breaking some of the immersion that the books managed to conjure. Similarly, the use of code words is both formally clever but practically problematic. I love the idea of a clue being hidden in the code words and the code words becoming a message, but I think if you're going to do that, you need to be fairly confident that the player is going to get all the code words in the right order without too much difficulty. And that's not something that the Crimson Tide's very open design makes entirely likely. It is a genuinely brilliant bit of formal design, but one I think would probably sit better in a story that was more linear. It's just too easy to miss code words and get code words out of order. The second issue is that the clue it provides tells you that you need to use the answer to a riddle from earlier in the story at a critical juncture. The answer to the riddle is not especially difficult, though it is yet another maths puzzle. What's weird is that there is no reason provided as to why the answer to the riddle should be helpful in the particular circumstances you find yourself in. Knowing the answer allows you to spot an assassin, but why the ability to answer riddles about the height of a tree should help anyone spot assassins is never really specified. It makes spotting the assassin feel very weird when you read it, and you're very aware that you're doing something that has a game effect that is not strongly tied to a narrative effect. These issues with logic can make parts of the book feel almost dreamlike because there is sometimes a disconnect between the game and the story. I don't actually mind that too much. The prose is solid enough and the situations are intriguing enough that the bizarre atmosphere was more pleasant than it was problematic. What all of these examples indicate is that Paul Mason is very good at coming up with mechanics, but struggles to tie those mechanics into the story. They exist seemingly in separate worlds. Both the mechanics and the story are great taken on their own, but they aren't integrated into a satisfying whole. The code word and the strange clue add to the difficulty of the book. There's only one path to the most completely successful ending, and you have to do everything exactly right in the right order. That's something that is manageable in designs that are more linear, but the very freedom you are given meshes quite badly with this single path to ultimate success. However, it is much more forgivable here than in other books because there are so many other endings to find along the journey, but I do think it would have benefited from being a bit more forgiving. I love an intricate puzzle of a game book, House of Hell, for example, but House of Hell's design and relatively focused area makes exploring feel a bit more approachable than it does here. They're both hard, but House of Hell feels somehow fairer. If I've been harsh about the mechanics, it's very much from a place of love. If there's one thing I wish game book designers did better on the whole, it's focusing on the story first and only including the mechanics that add to the story and themes of the book. Although Ferocity is fine and clever, the book would not have been materially worse if Ferocity hadn't been included and the process of learning to live without revenge had only been explored through the story. It's effectively doubling up something that the story is doing anyway. I don't think the game book would have been worse if you'd cut out the age mechanic either. The book isn't really about either of those things. It's about someone learning to move on from a terrible event and not allowing it to define their future. This premise is so good that it doesn't need much in the way of mechanical support. I get wanting to expand the timescale to show the process taking a long time, but I think you could have written it in a way that suggested the passage of time without drawing attention to the problems that passage of significant amounts of time create for the narrative. In the end, The Crimson Tide has a whole raft of problems, but none of them are quite enough to make the book bad. I absolutely loved discovering that the story it was telling was not the story it claimed to be telling. It's got a very strong theme, and the world it paints feels very coherent, which is another thing I'm a huge fan of. If there's a lesson that you can take away from it, it's that you can absolutely use a fantasy game book to tell stories with big themes and big ideas. I think a lot of game book creators focus on the game side of the equation, but you can do great things if you focus on the book side of the equation as well. It's arguably too hard and the mechanics don't quite land, but there's still so much fun to be had exploring the world and discovering the story. And all of the various endings was an absolute revelation to me. It's definitely one that's stuck in my mind in the best possible way. That is all for this episode. Join me in a couple of weeks when we'll be heading back to Orb for the next book in the Way of the Tiger series. It's going to be fascinating to see how that one turns out. Sequels are hard, especially proper sequels rather than thematic sequels set in the same area. If you want to get in touch with me in the meantime, you can do so by emailing me at hjdoomretrofun@gmail.com or by following me on Blue Sky at hjdoom. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.